Don will talk about Sonora. Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett, and we're a proud member of the Dialogue Podcast Network, a collective of independent, interesting podcasts who promote thoughtful, respectful, and engaging inquiry and discussion of all aspects of the LDS tradition, thought, arts, and culture. Find out more at dialoguejournal.com/podcastnetwork. That's all one word. dialoguejournal.com/podcastnetwork. You'll definitely be interested in the other latest episodes, so from our podcast as well as others. One of the major stories in the Book of Mormon is the story of when Nephi killed Laban. Why was Laban drunk in the first place? Historian Don Bradley thinks that Laban might have been celebrating the Passover, and we'll discuss why Laban was also wearing his military uniform. So you're going to want to check out this conversation. It's really cool. Well, so one of the things that I found interesting about your book was this idea that there was a compass and a Masonic compass and square that was on top of that.
On top of the plates.
On top of the plates. A few reasons why that is really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Number one is when we think of Masonry and Mormonism, we think that that generally happened in Nauvoo in the 1840s.
Yes.
And so you're really pushing the timeline back with that. Now, I've also talked with Cheryl Bruno and Claire Barris, and they're right along
Love them,
your lines.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so... And I also spoke with Dan Vogel recently, he made a big deal about Masonry didn't happen until the polygamy period, and that was how Joseph was able to keep secrets. And so this whole idea of a Masonic compass and square on the plates pushes that whole timeline back a decade, at least, or more than a decade.
Oh, yeah.
And so can you talk about that? And
sure.
And what are these Masonic influences with the Book of Mormon?
Sure. So something that listeners might know, might not, is that I've had a very circuitous spiritual journey, to say the least. At the time that I did that research that I mentioned for Brian Hales, gathering, you know, every conceivable source on Joseph Smith and polygamy over a course of 2 years, I was an ex-Mormon. I had left the church. I'd lost my faith, continued active for a few years. After I lost my faith, went inactive, and eventually left the church, officially had my name removed from the records because I thought I didn't have anything to contribute to the church. And I thought the church ultimately wouldn't want me because I would be publishing findings the way that I was interpreting them at the time that, you know, they were not faith-promoting findings, right? They were, the way I was constructing the Mormon past was faith-demoting. And so so I left. And I was out of the church officially for 5 years. It was during that time that I did my... research on Justice Polygamy for Brian. And after having spent several years exploring a model of Joseph Smith as opportunist and considering of every single thing he did and said, what was in it for him? I was asking that question and looking at, you know, all the known sources on Joseph Smith's relationships with women, I came back to the church.
Okay. Polygamy brought you back to the church?
No, people say that, and that's not right. No, I did not return to the church because of Joseph Smith's polygamy. I mean, in a way, I returned in spite of it, by which I don't mean that, like, Joseph Smith's polygamy was such a horrible thing. What I mean is polygamy is very off-putting to me, okay? It's a difficult subject,
mm-hmm.
right? And Joseph's practice of it is actually really difficult.
Yes, absolutely.
It's more difficult in some ways to deal with than, say, like Brigham's practice or others. It got off to a very rocky start. But the evidence on Joseph Smith's polygamy and these other things that I had been researching for years is ultimately consistent with faith. Now, it's not consistent with a simplistic black and white dichotomous faith, like maybe most of us in the church grew up with, right? But if you take those different puzzle pieces of church history, they may not fit into the simple little puzzle that we've had, that little picture puzzle, but they fit into a larger puzzle. You can take, in my experience, all the data, right, on Joseph Smith, all the positive sources, all the difficult sources, right, and they fit into a larger picture. And so I have a sort of evolving personal model of, you know, for understanding Joseph Smith that I'm sort of trying to progressively get out there in publications. So and with this being a major installment in that for me, my first book. So what triggered this return to the church? Right? I'd been so far out of the church and so definite in my view that, like, I knew that the church was not true, you know? So after studying all these kind of wild things about Joseph Smith, you know, knowing all about his personal sex life and, like, spending years trying to understand any hint of self-serving motive or, you know, being really well aware of his flaws and having studied specifically the most difficult aspects of his life, what in the world would have brought me back to the church, right? So actually, it was, there were two, they may not sound like they'd be interrelated projects, but two closely interrelated projects that I was doing, and this is 9.5 years ago.
Okay.
One of them was on the Lost 116 Pages. I was already 5 years or so into trying to figure out what was in those. The other one was on Joseph Smith's First Vision. And what I was positing was that Joseph Smith, that the First Vision was Joseph Smith's initiation, calling, or as I came to say, his initiation as a seer. Like, it's literally his first vision. And what is it to be a seer? Well, it's somebody who has visions. It's somebody who has second sight, who sees spiritual things that the rest of us don't. There were other things that lined up with that. There's an account of Joseph's first vision from Fanny Alger's brother, John Alger, who heard Joseph tell the story in the Joseph Smith Senior Home in Curtin. So this private family setting where Joseph Smith's going to talk more about intimate details as opposed to the public accounts that we're more familiar with. Joseph tells them in the Joseph Senior Home that at the beginning of the vision, God touched his eyes, and then he was able to see the vision. Well, this set off all kinds of resonances for me. I mean, Jesus in the New Testament, multiple places, in the Synoptic Gospels and in John, just touches people's eyes. They're blind, he touches their eyes, and then they can see. We're all spiritually blind. This is the human condition, right? We can't see through the veil. We just see natural things, not spiritual things. To be a seer is to see as God sees more. It's to see into the spiritual world. It's to no longer be spiritually blind, right? The first vision is a kind of healing, one angle to look at it from, right? A kind of healing from spiritual blindness. In the Kirtland Endowment, different parts of people's bodies are anointed, including their eyes, right, to enable them to see. And so there are so many things that this resonates with. In the book of Abraham, God puts his hand, Abraham says this, on Abraham's eyes in Abraham chapter 3, and that's how Abraham can see all the stars, right? When God touches your eyes, it enables you to see. There are other scriptural accounts of this. There are parallels in the story of the brother of Jared. And this started to all come together for me. How the Lost Pages come into it is there was actually a story from Joseph Smith Sr. that of how the interpreters are found. So the Book of Mormon, the Nephite Urim and Thummim, right, that Joseph Smith later has with the plates. So the Book of Mormon text that we have tells us about the interpreters. It tells us about how the brother of Jared originally gets the interpreters from God, right? When God touches the stones with his fingers, right? Christ touches them. Then it tells us later about Nephite kings having the interpreters, Mosiah the Second, King Benjamin. It's implied in Omni, Mosiah the First, right? Benjamin's dad. But it never tells us how the Nephites got the interpreters. If the interpreters start out with the Jaredites, and then suddenly we pop into the story later, and we're like, oh, the Nephites have them. How do the Nephites get them? Well, our Book of Mormon text doesn't tell us that. And scholars have pointed this out. Sidney Sperry pointed this out as one of the unanswered questions of the Book of Mormon. John Tvetness, right? Close readers have seen something's missing. Sperry's been left out. And actually, the story wasn't left out. It was put in. The manuscript that it was in was stolen, so we don't have it. That doesn't mean it wasn't there. Mormons assuming that we already know that the Nephites had gotten the interpreters. The Book of Mormon actually tells us whenever the Nephites get sacred relics, right? There's a story of how they get the Lehona, how they get the brass plates, where the gold plates come from, how they get the Sword of Laban. It's all laid out for us, except the interpreters. So, Joseph Sr. talks to an interviewer, a Palmyra neighbor of his, Fayette Latham, young businessman in Palmyra. This is early 1830. The Book of Mormon is at the Grandin Press in Palmyra. Everybody's hearing about it. There's a lot of buzz about it. But it's still, since it's still at press, you can't read it yet. You can't actually just dive in and find out about it. So Fayette Latham and his cousin are curious about this book. So what do? They show up at the Joseph Smith Sr. home, and they start asking questions. Joseph Sr. grants them an extensive interview, which Fayette Latham, it's not exactly clear how he preserves the information. Mark Ashurst McGee with the Joseph Smith papers has argued that Fayette Latham must have taken contemporaneous notes because he has such close, verifiable detail about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith Sr. relates the coming forth of the Book of Mormon to Fayette Latham, then tells them the story in the Book of Mormon, which he can't yet read for himself, right? There are funny things about his telling of that story. So many aspects of it are really recognizable, right? He says, well, there's this prophet, and he's warned by God to travel out into the wilderness, and he takes his family, and they travel out 3 days by the Red Sea, and God commands them to go back and get this record, and so on. This is a familiar narrative, mm-hmm. right? Now, Fayette Latham's never read the Book of Mormon. He doesn't actually remember, he doesn't know any of the names. He just knows there are these guys. He tells narrative, not names, okay? Tells familiar narrative. His narrative is very heavy on the first part of Nephite history, the part that corresponds to the Lost Pages. Once he gets about halfway through Mormon's abridgment, Joseph Smith Sr. hardly tells them anything else. He just tells them, well, they had a lot of wars. Jesus came. They broke into tribes. They destroyed each other. They're gone. For the first part of that narrative that corresponds to the period covered by the Lost Pages, Joseph Sr. gives some really detailed narration of things that were in it. It looks like Joseph Sr. is telling these guys what was such detail about what was in the first part of that manuscript, the first part of the Book of Mormon narrative, because they weren't going to be able to read all of that. Some of that's missing. And sure enough, when you look at the narratives that he gives, he tells the familiar story, sometimes garbles details, right? But he tells the familiar story, and then he adds new details to that narrative. And they're details that fit hand in glove. It's like, wait, that's not in the Book of Mormon, but it would fit beautifully.
Can you give an example?
Here's an example. Sure. And I wrote a paper about this. It's not a paper, actually. It's a chapter that's in the book. It's in the book as chapter 7 called A Passover Setting for Lehi's Exodus. But if you look in the journal Interpreter, Latter-day Saint Journal about Scripture, mostly, they published most of that chapter, a large excerpt from that chapter, as an interpreter piece just a few weeks back. There's also, I think, a listenable, an audio version of
it. It was your chapter.
Yeah. It's my chapter, yeah. And one of the details, as I lay out there, that Joseph Smith Sr. gives about this early part of the Book of Mormon narrative is he's telling the story of Nephi and the brass plates. Again, he doesn't remember names, so he doesn't name Nephi and Laban, but he's describing them, right? This prophet's son goes back to get this record, and he finds the guy who he tried to get it from, and that guy is lying drunk in the street. It's obvious who he's talking about. But he says that the reason that the guy was drunk is because there was a great feast going on in the city at the time.
Oh.
So think like Jewish festival, right? So Jewish festival being celebrated in Jerusalem. Now think about what our Book of Mormon text doesn't say that. Small plates doesn't say that. Think about what the small plates do say. They say, among other things, that Laban was out by night among the elders of the Jews, and he comes home drunk. If he's just out carousing, he's got really high-profile drinking buddies, right? He's out with the elders. Notice something else that's crucial to the story. He's wearing armor, and he's carrying a sword. They go out with his drinking buddies? I mean, the first and final days of Passover in Judaism are known as holy convocations, per the Hebrew Bible. They are group celebrations where the Israelites get together, they have these feasts. This would be an occasion to dress up, if you will. Okay? So this account that Laban was drunk from Joseph Sr., that Laban was drunk because of a feast being celebrated, would help to explain why Laban is out in armor and sword, drinking by night with the elders of the Jews, and why when Nephi, pretending to be Laban, goes to Zoram and he's like, hey, yeah, let's go get the brass plates, scriptures, and take them out to the elders, my brothers. Zoram's like, yeah, that makes sense, right? He doesn't seem to bat an eye about that. Well, if it's Passover and there's a religious celebration, that makes sense. If Laban's out carousing with his drinking buddies, kind of makes less sense, right? And there are other things. There are several things.
Why is he wearing armor and a sword? I don't have a gun or anything. I don't bring a gun or a knife to any of my parties.
I think it would just be a more formal form of dress for the time than just going out in regular clothes.
Like a military dress uniform or something?
Well, Laban is presented as a commander. I mean, it says Nephi's brothers are afraid of Laban because he can command 50, yea, even he can slay 50. So he's a soldier, is a formidable soldier, and he's a commander of soldiers. There were actually, in ancient Israel, in the Hebrew Bible, there were what were known as captains of 50. I mean, it's suggested there he's a captain of 50. So he's a military man, just like for a special occasion today, maybe a military person wears their uniform. He's kind of wearing his uniform. I mean, this is sort of like, again, creating a model, right? Taking the data that we have, how does it fit together? Well, the data that we have, and there are several other things, right, that comprise the body of this chapter, where even the words that the Spirit speaks to Nephi, it is better that one man should perish than a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief. Where's that from? What is that parallel? That's Caiaphas in the New Testament saying the exact same words about Jesus when Caiaphas is issuing a Passover prophecy. There's a Passover context where that shows up in the New Testament. And I show in this chapter, in this interpreter piece, how that Passover context of Caiaphas's prophecy interweaves with the Passover context of Nephi's commandment from the Spirit. It has to do with the how Passover begins with the Exodus, the slaying of the firstborn. The firstborn Egyptians have to die so that the Israelite nation can be preserved, so they can be freed from Egypt and go out and, you know, live as their own nation in the Promised Land and so on. Anyway, so this source from Joseph Smith Sr. helps us better understand what's going on in our Book of Mormon text by adding a detail to the narrative that would fit, but is not in our Book of Mormon text. Right? Once you plug in this Passover context, Lehi's Exodus looks different. Lehi's Exodus is more like the biblical Exodus, which is where Passover begins. Passover, of course, in a Christian context, is understood to be about Christ. It's portending, prefiguring, Jesus coming and offering himself as the Lamb of God. Well, it turns out that Nephi and Lehi, talking about their visions, talk about the Messiah as the Lamb of God, pointing to this larger meaning of Passover. This Passover context actually can help us to reframe the beginning of the Book of Mormon and help us to understand. In the Book of Mormon, we say it's another testament of Jesus Christ, right? That's even, we've added that as a subtitle. But then, like, you open up the book, and it's not really talking about Jesus. It's talking about this guy, Lehi, this ancient Jew and his family, and how they need this temporal deliverance from the destruction of Jerusalem. Well, you plug in the fact that this all happens in the context of Passover, and Lehi's temporal deliverance from destruction becomes a type of the Messiah, the Lamb of God's deliverance of all of humankind. And so the Book of Mormon, through that frame, really from the start, really actually literally is a book about Christ. This is another testament of Jesus Christ, beginning, very beginning of the lost pages to the end. So the inference here that I'm making, of course, is how did Joseph Smith Sr. have this detail that fits so beautifully and makes more sense of the early part of the Book of Mormon? Because he knows from his son and possibly from Martin about the contents of that lost manuscript and that Passover context that was in there. There are several new added details like this in Joseph Sr.'s narration of the early history of the Nephites. Really, really cool ones. So the last one that he gives is actually the story of the finding of the interpreters. And the story that he gives of the finding of the interpreters, it's absolutely wild. It echoes the Exodus narratives in the Bible of Moses at Sinai, just like Book of Mormon narrative that we have heavily echoes the Exodus narrative. It echoes it systematically, recognizably. It interweaves with Book of Mormon narratives that we have. This narrative from Joseph Sr. answers a question that the Book of Mormon text we have raises but never answers. How did the Nephites get the Jaredite interpreters? And the part that shocked me, okay, and that interweaved with my first vision ideas, right, on how this is first vision's a narrative of how Joseph Smith becomes seer, is this narrative about how the Nephites get the interpreters. So in this narrative, Fayette Latham reports from Joseph Sr., the Nephites, they're in the New World and they're traveling. They're on an exodus. They build a tabernacle, which in the Bible, it's a portable temple. It means you're between stationary temples like the Israelites on the exodus, right? That only happens twice in our extant Book of Mormon text. Generally, the Nephites have an established temple. First, Nephi's temple, right? They have an exodus to the New World. They have no temple. Then they build Nephi's temple. Then they have an exodus under Mosiah the First from Nephi's temple to the land of Zarahemla, where they build Mosiah's temple. Okay. So these are the two points at which his narrative of an exodus and a tabernacle would plug in. They're in his narrative, they're on an exodus. They're being led by the Liahona on this exodus in the New World. And the Liahona leads this man to an object. It's a weird object. He doesn't know what it is. And so he takes it, he carries it in his hand into the tabernacle that they've built, and he talks with God. So in ancient Israel, of course, in the Bible, when you have the tabernacle, when you have the temple, there are different veils. There's sort of inner sanctums that increasingly get more sacred till you get to the Holy of Holies, the holiest place. Right? And in that is the Ark of the Covenant, and there the presence of God is understood to reside behind this final veil. So this man, whom I argue, although Latham doesn't remember the name, whom I argue in my book is Mosiah the First on his Exodus. This man carries this object in the tabernacle. Presence of God, presumably from behind this veil, asks him, "What is that in your hand?" And his answer to this, "What is that?" question, given by Latham, is he did not know, but had come to inquire. So he's asked, God asks him, "What is that in thy hand?" or "What is that in your hand?" "I don't know, I've come to inquire." God tells him, "Take it, put it on your face. Veil your face with an animal skin." He does, and he can see anything. The object is the interpreter's. And he uses it by veiling his face with this animal skin. This again has echoes of Moses. Moses comes down from Sinai, his face is glowing, he veils his face. And the question, "What is that in thine hand?" is from Moses on Sinai at the burning bush. Again, so many complex biblical echoes.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with historian Don Bradley. In our next conversation, we'll talk about what was in the lost pages that touches on the temple endowment ceremony. Don thinks that there are some non-members that gave clues into this who clearly never ever did the temple endowment ceremony.
This Fayette Latham guy, he's not just confabulating this. He's remembering what Joseph Sr. told him. And the narrative that he gives has everything to do with temple. It's Nauvoo endowment stuff. And the thing is, Latham was never a Mormon, was never a Latter-day Saint. He wouldn't have gone through the temple. At this time, neither would Joseph Sr. Joseph Sr. never goes through the Nauvoo temple. He dies before the endowment is instituted. So why is there Nauvoo endowment material in this Lost Pages Book of Mormon narrative?
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available at either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com and you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript. And over here, we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.